devastation rained on man. Saw his future drip, dripping down the train. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain. And he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
To tell people to mortgage their houses and leave their children to acquire tickets to a hit Broadway show. But Hamilton might just about be worth it. At least to anyone who wants proof that the American musical is not only surviving, but also evolving in ways that should allow it to thrive and transmogrify in years to come. That's from a review in the New York Times about the smash hit, Hamilton. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. It hardly seems likely. A hip-hop musical about America's first Secretary of the Treasury becomes a Broadway sensation, winning 11 Tony Awards and a Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Joining me to discuss and sample Hamilton are three guests. Sarah Marty is director of Four Seasons Theater, and she's teaching a course on Hamilton for the Division of Continuing Studies. Joshua Calhoun, professor of English at the UW-Madison, who specializes in Shakespeare and other poets. And Alexander Shasko, who teaches African-American history and the history of black music and hip-hop in UW's Department of Afro-American Studies. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Emily.
This is an amazing success story and a real game changer. Sarah, I know you've worked with all kinds of American musicals. Tell us what Hamilton means in the sort of history of this genre.
So when we think of the term game changer, it can apply in a lot of different ways. It can be in terms of the structure of the musical. When we look at things like Showboat, 1927, coming out of a tradition of review shows with very little narrative plot, not much structure, borrowing heavily from opera and bringing in a huge epic story, an American story. It's in English. It has operatic voices, huge production values, a significant change from what happened before. If we fast forward quite a few decades, we think of the change from huge musicals like Les Mis, very operatic and structured, to Rent, rock and roll, ensemble cast, rock band on stage, current topic, looking at the AIDS epidemic, people living in New York, big reaction, revolution in terms of what's happening in musical theater. And we fast forward again, 2015 to Hamilton. It's drawing on all of those massive changes in structure, in form, in casting. It's looking at a different business model and how you interact with your audience and how you're merchandising, how you're selling tickets. And it's also bringing together some things you normally wouldn't put together, hip-hop and musical theater with the founding fathers. Right? So many things. I'm so excited to have Josh and Alexander here today to talk about this.
Well, Josh, you're known as a Shakespeare scholar. So what are you doing talking about Hamilton?
That's a great question. I think that so much of what Hamilton does that is exciting is it plays with language in ways that I really want to encourage my students to be playing with language in Shakespeare when they read to understand what's happening there. I like to show them poets from the late 1500s who are talking about, hey, you know, we could write poetry in English. We don't have to write it in Latin or in French. The English language is actually pretty good for writing poetry, and we can make it a respectable language for writing poetry. And we assume because Shakespeare's written in English that this must have always been an understood to be this beautiful, amazing language. But no, at the time that Shakespeare was writing, they were really proving the power of the English language as a way of writing and thinking about how they can ornament it and mix it up to use the common dialect to create something beautiful and poetic. And so I see a lot of overlaps there. We're taking something like hip-hop and trying to say, okay, look, this actually will completely work in a Broadway medium. It's suited to it. It's good enough for it. There's no reason it shouldn't be part of this conversation. And here, let me show you how that works, which Hamilton has obviously done.
So you hear all kinds of rhyme and meter going on in Hamilton that don't seem that far off from Shakespeare?
Absolutely. I was just looking at George Puttenham, the great writer of the Art of English Poesy, and he's writing in the 1590s that the fashioning of our maker's language and style to such a purpose as it may delight and allure as well the mind as the ear of the hearers with a certain novelty and strange manner of conveyance. And I think this applies as well to Shakespeare's writing. We both want to hear it, and then we want to go back and read it. And I find the same thing is so true with everyone I talk to about Hamilton. They heard the recording, and now they want to look at the script or go to Rap Genius. Or they need to see it as well. And that's one of the beautiful things I think good poetry does is it catches our ear and it catches our mind. We want to see what it looks like as well.
And Alexander, what do you bring into the discussion of Hamilton with your background in teaching African-American history and music?
Well, obviously, one of the reasons why Hamilton has become such a sensation is the way in which it has integrated hip hop into the world of Broadway, but also in the way in which it has tried to be part of the story of race, the story of the immigrant experience, stories about inclusion in America, and who gets to be an American and who doesn't get to be an American. And I think that those are questions that have been deeply ingrained in American history. It's a question we have asked time and time again, and is certainly something that we are asking in the present day as well. So these are pretty deep questions that are part of both the African-American experience and, of course, by extension, then the American experience and the history of race itself. On top of that, of course, you then have hip hop, and you have the fact that this is a kind of coming of age for hip hop on Broadway. And by extension, then, for Broadway audiences and for Broadway producers and creators who can now see a way in which hip-hop can be part of that story on Broadway. And so for all of those reasons, it's very exciting. And, of course, there are a lot of specifics that I'm sure we'll get into over the course of the hour. But among them are this is a story of New York. Mm-hmm. And hip-hop is a story of New York, right? It has its roots in Jamaica. It has a much deeper history to it. But New York is at the center of the story. And so there's a way in which hip-hop is really appropriately telling part of this story of New York's history for people in the present.
And what do you make of the fact, and there's been dozens of articles about this, that the cast is deliberately putting African-American and Latino actors in roles where you would not expect to see them, so that you have an African-American Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Alexander Hamilton not played by your standard white men?
Well, obviously, that has been something of the hook for the entire thing, right? Like, it's the first thing that many people have noted about Hamilton even before it was actually heard or seen by anyone, because the casting was going on and then people understood that that was part of what it was going to be about. It's a complex question, as are most questions of race. On the one hand, I think it's absolutely true that that by doing this and sort of inverting racial categories, it is making the statement that African Americans, Latinos, people of color can claim that heritage of the founding fathers for themselves, that they can be part of that story for themselves, that immigrants can incorporate that experience at a time when some of our political rhetoric doesn't necessarily validate that perspective on the world. At the same time that's the case, it also brings up some complicated questions. I know certainly within the world of African-American studies and among historians and other people who think about race, it is a complicated question about what happens when you invert racial categories, but when you don't actually have many characters who were originally African-American or people of color in the play itself. And so some of the conversation around it has been about whether or not this is a way of bringing questions of race into this story, or whether it is continuing that exclusion, because it's not the story of slaves at the time. It is the story of these white male founding fathers. So there are a lot of interesting questions that are around it, and I think Lin-Manuel Miranda certainly is somebody who is aware of that and wanted to have those questions raised as a result of creating this work.
I wonder if we could set up one number, Sarah, and then listen to it and then come back at it from different angles.
Why don't we start with My Shot? I think that'd be a really great one to start with.
Well, can you set it up for us in terms of what's happening in the musical and anything you want us to know about Miranda as composer, lyricist, producer, whatever?
So in several interviews, he's referenced the fact that it took him an entire year to write this one number in what is a very long and complex musical. The whole show is about 2 hours and 45 minutes. And the reason I think it encapsulates so much of what happens in the musical is there are many layers to even just the title, My Shot. The musical itself centers on Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton and how each of them have a very different approach to the idea of making their mark on history, on taking their shot, on being remembered, on having an impact. And they both come at it from very different angles, but they're both thinking about their shot the entire time. There's also the reference to the duel. And in dueling practices of the time, often there would be a challenge, there would be the duel, and you would have the chance to defend your honor, but it was understood that you would throw away your shot. You would aim above somebody's head. Nobody would get hurt. You'd call it a draw. That's the end of it. We had our duel. We defended our honor, but nobody died. And later on, as we know, there are two duels in the story. There's the duel of Alexander Hamilton's son, Philip, and, of course, the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And according to legend, one did throw away his shot and one didn't. There's also all the references to their political careers going throughout. And I think the other reason to select this piece is that the poetry and internal rhyme scheme and just the complexity of what happens is really pretty amazing. And you hear echoes of this particular number throughout the entire show. It comes back in the end of Act One with the world goes upside down. It's in many, many numbers throughout the show. So we'd love to start there.
So My Shot from Hamilton.
I am not thrown away my shot. I am not thrown away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not thrown away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19. My mind is older. These New York City streets get colder. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame. But damn, it's getting dark, so let me spell out the name. I am the A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R. We are meant to be a colony that runs independently. Meanwhile, Britain keeps shitting on us endlessly. Essentially, they tax us relentlessly. Then King George turns around, runs a spending spree. He ain't never gonna set his descendants free. So there will be a revolution in this century. Enter me,
he says in parentheses.
Don't be shocked when your history book mentions me. I will lay down my life if it sets us free. Eventually, you'll see my ascendancy. And I am not thrown away my shot. I am not thrown away my shot. And yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not thrown away my shot.
So much happening in this song, My Shot. I don't even know where to start. That's so much language is going on. Josh, tell us about what you're hearing with rhyme and meter and just, you know, the many things that are happening with the English language here.
Yeah, well, there are two things that I think are really happening here that are so important to the whole show, which is we're think about how you're establishing character and a character we can sympathize with, but who we also have some questions about. Sarah, I'm sure, can talk more about this, but this is kind of that moment in any show where the protagonist steps forward and says, here's what I want to do. Here's what I really need. Here's my motivation and why you should keep, you know, why you shouldn't leave an intermission.
It's the I Am I Want song.
Okay. See, yeah, there's a name for this. And this is what's so wonderful about working with Alexander and Sarah having these conversations. We've had a lot of exciting conversations because we bring very different things to the table. But I see the characterization there. He's laying out who his character is, what he wants. And I also know from reading some of the notes from the end that he changes, that he sets up a metaphor, much like in Macbeth, we're going to see the constantly references to the moon. This My Shot really becomes an important idea. It's both literal and figurative throughout the play. And at the end, he actually dies because does he or does he not throw away his shot? And he had decided to say what he did. And the artistic director, we have a wonderful artistic director with us here, Sarah, and how important they are. Oscar Eustace at the Public Theater came to him and said, you know, your decision, the way that you're casting this is making him look like he, you know, definitely threw away his shot. You know, I have some notes for you that are based on my reading of Shakespeare. And this is, I mean, this is actually what Eustace said, because Eustace runs, is also director for Shakespeare in the Park, where that's connected with public theater. And he said, you know, what if we open this up a little bit? And I was reading this, some notes from this amazing book on Hamilton, and Len says, you know, before he talked to Oscar Eustace about this, he was really felt confident. He changed it so that these final lines turned him into a question. Did he throw away a shot at the end? He's not sure, and it left it open. And he said, what you want from that moment is the same thing you want from Romeo and Juliet. I'm badly quoting Lin right now, Lin-Manuel Miranda. You want the audience to be gasping, that, you know, that moment, don't drink the potion. And he said that he says, and this is a direct quote, that Oscar pushed until we got the audience gasping. So that sets up this characterization for the entire play, but also the language is so dense, which maybe we could talk more about the characterization and come back to some of the language. But, you know, obviously there's a lot happening in terms of rhythm and rhyme.
Well, and there's such an irony when he said, the problem is I've got a lot of brains but no polish. But this is so polished with the language. You know, there's a discrepancy between the way Alexander Hamilton is using language and then the fact that we're supposed to see him as scrappy and of the streets.
But it's also the language that he's using. So I was just marking up my own lyric sheet here. I'm gonna get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I amaze and astonish. The problem is I got a lot of brains but no polish, so astonish and polish. I got a holler just to be heard with every word I drop knowledge. So the rhyme with college and knowledge comes back, you know, six lines later. And just the density of that one tiny little, you know, 15-second snippet of one song in this entire show, and the amount of craft it took just to put that together is really incredible.
It makes you really believe him when he says it took him a year to do it.
I know. Initially, like, really? That long? But this is another reason, and we referenced rapgenius.com. It's this incredible website where they've crowdsourced annotating the lyrics for the entire show. So anybody in the world who wants to take a shot at, no pun intended, at annotating and saying, where did this come from? What does this mean? How do these things relate? Can log in. And it's actually been monitored by the folks who are on the production team and by Lin-Manuel Miranda. And they now link directly to those lyrics from the website after crowdsourcing all of that information. But Alexander, you should jump in.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, what genius.com and what others have pointed out really reflects is how deeply Lin-Manuel Miranda is ensconced in the world of hip-hop itself, that his knowledge of hip-hop is clearly very, very deep, particularly for the period within when he grew up with it, right? Which is how most people know music best, you know? I mean, they tend to know the period when they were in grade school, high school, you know, those first few years after high school. You're absorbing all of it. You're defining your own identity around the music that you're listening to. Maybe your memory is better. That certainly seems to be the case for me. And so, you know, the 90s is really at the center of how he describes and sort of shapes the hip hop that we hear in this song and really throughout most of the show, although not the whole thing, as I'm sure we'll talk about. But you can hear it in here. You can hear direct references to Notorious B.I.G., to Mobb Deep, to DMX. You can hear references to Busta Rhymes, all on this song. And some of them are more explicit than others, but they are there, either in rhymes that are reflective or directly from many of those tracks. And so what this song, I think, does is really establish that period of hip-hop, that period of hip-hop when you had gangster rap alongside a lot of the veterans and this kind of second wave of New York hip-hop alongside, you know, some of what later come to be known problematically as kind of conscious rap or conscious hip-hop, all being heard at that same time on the radio. As a sort of golden age, you can hear that's the basis upon which he is doing his work on My Shot. I would say one other thing about hip hop and black music more generally that he's doing with this song, and that is that he's really establishing, as we said earlier, the motivation, but doing so in a way that is very much about the story of hip hop as well. These first three songs really do that. Note that the first two songs of the show, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, Sir, are literally naming the figures, and they are naming two individuals who feel invisible and feel slighted and want to be known. And that idea of wanting to be known and feeling invisible is really central to African-American music and to Black music, that it has long been a means by which African-Americans could have their voice heard because they couldn't be heard through more traditional forms of media. They weren't in the newspapers. They didn't have positions of power in society. And so, you know, all you have to do is think about Bo Diddley, right? Every Bo Diddley song names Bo Diddley, or Snoop Dogg. Every Snoop Dogg song seems to be about naming Snoop Dogg, kind of reaffirming your presence. And that's what those first two songs really do. And then with this third one, you get the motivation. And it's one of the iconic motivations in the history of hip hop, which is, you know, I am going to make it. I'm going to use the tools I have around me to make it and succeed. And in that sense, it's referencing countless hip hop songs. I mean, obviously Lose Yourself by Eminem is the most direct kind of connection here, but I don't think we can assume that that's what Lin-Manuel Miranda was building off of entirely, you know, that he's too well versed in this to think that it just came from one song. This is really about that drive that is such a part of how hip hop artists define themselves being placed then into a very different context.
And the interesting thing to me, too, is I listen to Alexander talk, and this is why these conversations are so exciting to me, is this is really just about a love for language and story. Because everything you say here about hip-hop, I'm sitting here thinking about Orlando and As You Like It. And that's my bent. That's my where I come from. But, yeah, you know, he starts off and Oliver is oppressing him, and he's going to – by the end, he gets the girl. He's writing this rhyming poetry that's not really very good, and then it gets better and he gets the girl. We have a very a similar narrative. We see that sort of narrative is an important narrative throughout all of drama. But also then how is it done in terms of the language? You know, just can't overstate. People want to say, well, you know, Shakespeare can't be Shakespeare because of the certain education he didn't have. But we look at a lot of the artists that Lin-Manuel Miranda is drawing from here, and they didn't have the sort of education that should have allowed them to put together this kind of linguistic brilliance that they've put together. They're playing with words and seeing what they can do with them, getting inside and outside of them. To me, that's just – it's so fun to listen to Hamilton in the same way it is to read Hamlet for me.
Yay, Hamlet.
Yay, Hamlet.
Let's listen to just a little more from My Shot.
I imagine death so much it feels more like a memory. When's it gonna get me? In my sleep, 7 feet ahead of me. If I see it coming, do I run or do I let it be? Is it like a beat without a melody? See, I never thought I'd live past 20. Where I come from, some get half as many. Ask anybody why we live it fast, and we laugh, reach for a flask. We have to make this moment last. That's plenty. Scratch that. This is not a moment, it's the movement. Where all the hungriest brothers with something to prove went. Foes oppose us, we take an honest stand. We roll like Moses, claiming our promised land. And if we win our independence, is that a guarantee of freedom for our descendants? Or will the blood we shed begin an endless cycle of vengeance and death with no defendants? I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. We need to handle our financial situation. Are we a nation of states? What's the state of our nation? I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing every expectation. Every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties and sorrow. For the first time I'm thinking past tomorrow.
And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Ayo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry. And I'm not throwing away my shot.
And there we have such a great example of this this narrative and of coming up from the bottom. But we also have this language that's being used to craft that narrative. We see allusion to Moses in the promised land, and that line, land, and if we win our independence. You know, we talk about rap genius. We talk about George Putnam. These are ways of describing poetry that's already been written. Putnam has a language. This would be technically anadiplosis, or he calls it the redouble. But there's language we can go back and apply to this, and that's what makes it fun. We get that narrative, but we also get this language that we can go back and unpack and critique.
And just to touch back on something that Alexander brought up a little bit earlier, what's
really fascinating to me about this entire show is how Hamilton is bringing together traditional musical theater structure with a completely different musical genre in a way that is so revolutionary. There's a new book out called The Secret Life of the American Musical, where they're drawing parallels between shows over 70 years of musical theater. And I'd love to later on touch on how this show draws from Les Mis, mm-hmm. Javert Valjean, from Rent with Mark and Roger, and how in those musicals early on, both characters have a song where they're stating who they are. And then it comes into what do they want and where are they trying to go in the show.
And there's these great lines referring to Gilbert and Sullivan and South Pacific, and it's almost every page of the musical there are allusions, and many that I'm sure are missing as well. We're going to explore more of the layers of Hamilton when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sarah Marty, Josh Calhoun, and Alexander Shashko, and we are talking about the smash hit Hamilton, unprecedented award-winning musical. Lin-Manuel Miranda said when he was at the White House before this actually came out, "I'm actually working on a hip-hop album, a concept album about the life of someone who embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton." I mean, that's a funny line about you would not match up a Treasury Secretary with hip-hop. But there's a lot more music happening in this show than just hip-hop. What are some of the other kinds of musical traditions that get drawn in here?
Well, it is interesting. Once he took the concept from being a mixtape and an album into a Broadway show, it obviously meant he was going to expand dramatically what he was doing. He was going to expand the number of characters and also to expand musically what the show would be like. And, you know, there is definitely a spot, we're about halfway through that first act, I guess more like a third of the way through the first act, when the music shifts gears. And when having established hip hop as the basic sound of the show, then kind of steps away a little bit and incorporates some different sounds.
So, for instance, in The Farmer Refuted, we hear a harpsichord, which would have been contemporary for the time of the Founding Fathers, underlaying what's happening on stage. And from there, we also move into the Beatles, the British Invasion, pop, the Partridge Family, in a very, very different way. And that sound, both of those sounds, the harpsichord and then the British Invasion sound, are actually reflecting the characters that are speaking at the time and what their motivations are in the story.
At the same time, though, that you're getting this other sound, you're still getting the hip-hop interest in a rap battle that happens here in The Farmer Refuted, and especially this fascination with what you can do with a rhyme scheme. And when we talk about the lyrics from Hamilton, or we talk about the lyrics from Notorious B.I.G., or we talk about the lyrics from Shakespeare, whoever it might be, we're describing something that's already happened. Mary Oliver, I use her poetry handbook to teach poetry. I think it's wonderful. She said, these poets don't always try very consciously to do each of these things. They're fascinated with language that comes out, and then this is the language we use to describe them. But there's some things that are happening in The Farmer Refuted in terms of the rhyme scheme. Lynn talks about having heard a tribute to the Puerto Rican MC Big Pun, where the tribute took all of his end rhymes and then rhymed them in a new song. And that's what he does here with The Farmer Refuted. At the same time, he's grabbing onto a tradition that is something he's used earlier, which is there'd be debates about exactly which it is, but there's a French term, bou rime, and there's another term that's also called a crambo. And this is a crambo, essentially a poem designed to exhaust all possible rhymes with a name. And this happens in Aaron Burr. And I don't think that Lynn sets out to say, yeah, I'm going to write a crambo about Aaron Burr's name, but it happens. It's what he does. And then he takes this other example where you see how you can take over somebody else's verse, inhabit it, by then taking their rhymes and using new end rhymes to create two opposing points of view. It's all part of this poetic play that there's a long tradition of describing. So here we have bound up a hip-hop style, in late 18th century musical style, and also this absolute fashion with verse that I think transects both of those periods.
Let's listen to Farmer Refuted.
He'd have you all unravel at the sound of screams, but the revolution is coming. The have-nots are gonna win this. It's hard to listen to you with a straight face. Chaos and bloodshed already haunt us. Our solution and even talk. And what about Boston? Look at the cost and all that we've lost. And you talk about Congress.
Does not speak for
my
me.
Dog speaks more eloquently than me.
So Farmers Refuted is picking up the story sort of at the dawn of the revolution, essentially. It is sort of talking about the debate that's going on over whether or not the revolution is a good idea. And it's placing this farmer who is speaking to a public audience about the sort of need to be loyal, with then Hamilton who comes in and responds. It's just one of many examples of the sort of just the sheer depth of information, the amount of plot that there is in this musical. And I think in a way that sheer depth of information, an overwhelming amount, which, I mean, all of us have talked about off the air about how there's just an overwhelming amount of material to discuss with Hamilton, to me, in a way, reflects some of the great TV shows of this moment. That really reflect shows like Breaking Bad or The Sopranos, Game of Thrones, shows that are constructed with just an overwhelming number of characters, of plot, that require a kind of commitment, even devotion, to being able to make sense of it and to put it all together. And this song, along with many others in Hamilton itself, really requires that of you. It requires you to really be placed in the history of the moment at the same time that you're also trying to navigate the language and all of the characters who are part of the story. And I think that part of the reason why the music then changes and shifts at this particular point in the play is because, in a way, the audience needs a rest. The audience really needs to catch its breath. It is not accustomed to seeing a Broadway musical performed at this speed consistently. And even with these breaks, it is moving at a speed that is, you know, at the high end, if not the highest of any in terms of words per minute of any kind of Broadway musical. So it's providing a break. It's providing a chance for the audience to catch its breath and also to be familiar to hear familiar sounds that maybe the audience, which, let's face it, the audience for Broadway shows, not necessarily a hip-hop audience, at least the paying audience, they might not be totally familiar with hip-hop. And so this is bringing in other sounds and other styles. We hear that even more directly with the next song, which is You'll Be Back, which has become one of the iconic songs of the show, and which Miranda talks about being the first one that he actually wrote, which sort of set part of the standard for how the characterizations would work. And in this song, it's King George who is responding to events on the other side of the Atlantic, and who's sort of looking incredulously at this revolt. This rebellion that he sees going on, convinced that it's going to fail, convinced that the mighty British crown is going to succeed, and that eventually these colonists will return. They will return to the fold. What makes the song so compelling is that, of course, this is a long-standing idea in American popular music, to write a song about a domineering member of a relationship who is sort of trying to console and reassure the other person in the relationship that everything is fine, everything is going to be great, even though a sort of threat, a sort of menace is hovering over that relationship. And there are songs along these lines that are incredibly poppy and happy, because it's that distinction between this kind of happy sound and the sort of dark, menacing theme that is underneath it, which gives the song its power, right? That publicly everything's fine, everything's going to be fine, but underneath there's a power relationship that is absolutely unhealthy, and You'll Be Back really speaks to that. What makes it fascinating, too, of course, is that Miranda has the masterstroke of one of those things that seems obvious in retrospect, but probably wasn't at the time, to use the music of the British invasion, right? To use a sound that would actually be British and would be a sort of counterpose to the hip hop that is the voice of this new young generation in America. And he does this in other places too. It's worth noting that Jefferson, for example, in all of the songs that he is featured in, is singing musical styles that range from the early period of the 20th century through basically the 1950s and 1960s. So he too is a sound of the past and not of the present or of the future, not of the present and future that the revolution or hip hop is providing. And so the sound of it really makes it fascinating as well. Everyone talks about the Beatles, and the Beatles are sort of central to the British invasion. But when I hear this, I hear like Herman's Hermits. I hear a group that was on the coattails of the British invasion, right? Like, and in a way, in the same way that the British crown is receding at this time, that it's losing its strength and its power, so too does the song kind of reflect an almost kind of banal version of the British invasion, right? This is not Strawberry Fields Forever. This is just da 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 da. You know, that's what you get. And so it's a very simplified version of it.
Let's hear King George.
The price of my love is not a price that you're willing to pay. You cry in your tea, which you hurl in the sea when you see me go by. Why so sad? Remember we made an arrangement when you went away. Now you're making me mad. Remember, despite our estrangement, I'm your man. You'll be back, soon you'll see. You remember you belong to me. You'll be back, time will tell. You remember that I served you well. Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da 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 da.
Sarah, I have a feeling that you, as someone who runs a theater company, might hear this number sung by people who are auditioning. It seems like one of those songs that will jump off the show and become something people sing, just as a separate number.
Definitely. I mean, it has so much charisma, and it's something that's catchy. It's something that when you hear it the first time, you can sing the melody back right away. It's at a slower pace than a lot of the other songs in the show. The lyrics are more memorable. They stick in your brain. They'll be there. And there's even that idea of the audience sing-along. And in great auditions, you want the director and the producer to be humming along with what you're singing. And to pull them in emotionally that way.
But isn't it kind of ironic that you've got King George, who's normally the villain of the piece, and he's doing this cheerful, upbeat, da-da-da-da-da song? I mean, what's going on there?
I think, as Alexander alluded to earlier, it's a play. It's a play on words in a way musically. It's a play on you as an audience member, because this is the bad guy. Yet here you are smiling and dancing along in your seat as he's, you know, da-da-da-da-da, and he's strutting across the stage. And in a way, it's also nostalgic, because that Broadway audience, you know, the average Broadway audience, the ticket buyers for musical theater, tend to skew towards baby boomers. So this is music that was their music when they were younger, just like for Lin-Manuel Miranda, hip-hop was the music he grew up with. So it's pulling many different directions all at once and in very complex layers as you go through that.
I would just add to that that the audience knows that King George is going to lose. There is no actual menace here from him, right? The audience knows that they are going to lose the war. And so you can sort of playfully watch from afar and kind of snicker and guffaw, because you know that he's not going to win. So the kind of lightheartedness to it is sort of letting you in on the joke. And in fact, as you see the subsequent performances of King George in the show, his clothes become more disheveled. He's clearly falling apart, and he's desperately trying to maintain appearances, but he can't, in fact, maintain those appearances. So the audience is in on this joke all from beginning to end.
Poetically, it's also
just bubblegum. And we're going to see after this, if you were to listen to the whole thing, you'd get to Right Hand Man, which is this brilliant set of lyrics with multiple voices. But if you see, he's rhyming, like he's trying to do rhymes that are such a, where he sets it up, you know, you say the price I will pay. All his rhymes are single syllable. When he tries to stray into something like away, he messes himself up. Until he gets to the end, he finds one multi-syllable rhyme and its subject. And he thinks he's really funny for finding this word subject, which can be both the subject of a sentence and you as my subject. And he beats it into the ground. It's such bad rhyming that it plays off everything else. And it really sets up everything else that we'll see later.
To play devil's advocate for a minute, is there any way that you can look sort of almost negatively at the fact that in order to appeal to the kind of high-paying audiences that might have wanted the kind of music that was more recognizable, or in order to kind of elevate the nature of this by alluding to Shakespeare, you know, there are lines quoted from Macbeth and so on, is that in a sense selling out to have to put in references to other things as if to validate it?
I don't think that they're there as validation. I think they're there as part of the narrative and musical structure of the piece. A good musical has variation. A good musical changes tempos. It changes the types of songs. You've got patter songs. You've got ballads. You've got up-tempo. You've got, you know, you really have to have that variety to keep a listener engaged. If everything sounded the same the entire time, people will tune out. And what's the part of the genius of the composition of this particular piece is that each character has a very distinct cadence, a particular type of phrasing their words, a certain kind of musical style. You know, Jefferson versus Alexander Hamilton versus Aaron Burr. Hamilton is a million words a minute. He's fast, only beaten by Jefferson when he's rapping. Aaron Burr, legato, lower, a little bit lower baritone or lower sound, slower, very measured, to match their personalities as well. Mm-hmm. And as you go through the show, you know, I heard excerpts of the show separately from seeing it. And you can get so much of that characterization just by the way it's musically written and the way that each character is laid out.
We're going to look at more of Hamilton when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. That's from the song The Reynolds Pamphlet in Act Two of the musical Hamilton. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sarah Marty, Joshua Calhoun, and Alexander Shashko, and we are talking about Hamilton. Well, Alexander, this is back to more the hip-hop sound, not sounding any more like the Beatles and other things.
And in fact, this song is not even like most of the hip-hop that's in Hamilton. It's actually the one song in the show that is pretty contemporary in its sound. I think the closest connection would really be to trap, which is a sound that really, it does emerge in the 90s in the South, but really becomes more popular later on and still maintains a kind of relevancy today. And trap is a very sort of bleak, very dark kind of sound, which is often associated with Tales of the Streets. And I think one of the things that makes it notable is that it is, of course, being used at a moment in the show when Hamilton is besieged, when he has when the affair that he has been having has been revealed, and where he now has to produce this pamphlet to defend himself. Well, he didn't have to, but he chose to.
So what I think is really fascinating about this particular moment is the Reynolds pamphlet was a 95-page document where Alexander Hamilton is responding to these allegations of corruption, 95 pages. And there are a lot of lyrics in this particular song that are lifted directly from that pamphlet, which we have as a primary source that you're able to see in archives. You know, it's digitized or you can see it in person. And there are many aspects of this show, many lyrics that are pulled from primary sources that, you know, go back to Ron Chernow's biography, his 800-plus page giant biography that somehow got distilled down to this 2-hour and 45-minute piece of theater. And it's fascinating to me to think of adapting a letter from that time into lyrics that are very in a very contemporary setting in this particular number and also just throughout the entire show.
But the history isn't always accurate. But then I guess Shakespeare did that too. You don't necessarily find in Macbeth and King Lear and the Richard plays and everything else, you don't always find 100% accuracy.
No, that's right, Emily. I mean, if you want to start taking shots at somebody who takes history, really changes it to be able to sell a play in front of an audience, you have to pick on Shakespeare a lot more than you pick on Lin-Manuel Miranda. He does it so much more in the history plays. And it works because I think it's also at the same time making the point, as does this show. It says over and over, you know, ask the question, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? It's picking up on that same thread that we see in something like Henry IV Part 2, which is really a retelling of Henry IV Part 1 in a way that then mixes it up a lot and has different people lying about what happened at the Battle of Agincourt at the opening. It reinforces the fact that history is not what happened. History is the story of what happened, told by whoever you're hearing it from.
And I take that back to Les Mis. When you go to Les Mis, you're seeing a musical adaptation of Victor Hugo's novel, which was Victor Hugo telling his version of what happened. So it's through many filters, it's through a particular perspective, but the idea is if you can create a piece of theater that's compelling enough to raise people's interest in wanting to learn more, mm-hmm. perhaps they'll go and they'll start to read other interpretations and other perspectives. Because truthfully, we don't actually know what happened. We know all of these different versions of what happened, and we know what was captured and what was preserved and what we have now, and we can use those pieces to try to determine. But the great thing is the inspiration. You know, want to learn more and you go to other places to learn more and try to figure out on your own and with others how that might have, you know, how do we get where we are?
And my understanding is that some high school groups are coming and are particularly interested in the cabinet duels. But just this idea that you have high school students getting interested in American Revolutionary history in a new way because of a musical like Hamilton is kind of exciting.
And this is something which also speaks to the moment, right? Why this show now? What is it about this show that is getting people's attention and getting them to think about these historical questions? That's often about the experiences that people are having in the present. And when you think about this show, it is asking a lot of different people can ask different questions as they and read into it what they want to read into it, right? Am I an American? Am I part of this legacy? What does it mean to be an immigrant? Does pulling yourself up by your bootstraps really happen? And does it happen to everyone, or does luck have to be part of it? Right, Hamilton and Burr with these parallel lines, and yet one becomes succeeds where another does not. All of these questions. What does it mean to have a government that works? What about Wall Street? Right. I mean, you have Wall Street in the middle of this story. We're celebrating the person who was partly responsible for a system which has had some serious questions of late. And so there are a lot of ways in which people are trying to reach for answers, and maybe this is one of those ways in which they're trying to do it.
Well, and the other thing that I think is really interesting is a lot of us learned about U.S. history in fifth grade from a textbook. And the image that we have is the image of originalism, where somehow all of the founding fathers agreed. And they were all these men who were learned and, you know, all in their mid-50s and their early 60s. And everybody had a consensus, and the Constitution is etched in stone and for the ages. And that they had the forethought of what would be happening 100, 200, you know, how many hundred years later. And that they were somehow divinely inspired to create this government in this world. And what you see in Hamilton is there was disagreement, like in the cabinet battles. And there were fights. And there were, even like we have today in politics, we don't agree. And we don't agree on many, 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 many things. And I think that the show articulates that in a way that's different than what most of us might have learned in the classroom as kids.
And the way we get a lot of that history is through this certain kind of prose that we read, which is normalized. It's almost naturalized prose. This is how this happened, right? And what's interesting about what's happening in something like Hamilton is it's both making it more formal, putting it into verse form. This is verse drama. And at the same time, it's making it so much more informal. It's bringing it into the, again, I've been reading a bit about how Oscar Eustace, this director of the public theater who's also involved with Shakespeare in the Park, was thinking, I mean, he had written that Len takes the language of the people and he heightens it by making it verse. It made me think of this one of the most amazing lines from James Baldwin where it's in an essay called Why I Stopped Hating Shakespeare. And in that essay, he talks about coming to realize that Shakespeare was jazz. Shakespeare is body. And he said the greatest poet in the English language found his poetry where poetry is found, in the lives of the people. I think it's simply that he walked his streets and saw them and tried not to lie about what he saw. And this reminds me so much of what I see happening here. You both have a formal verse at the same time, the informality where suddenly we're aware we're hearing it from somebody who sounds like they're telling a story. And we know that story is going to be influenced by other ideas in their head. We trust it, and yet we also have questions.
And I think this would, as a musical theater person, I would take this back to looking at shows like Hair, right? So Hair is the story of Jesus, right? But it's also the story of peaceful protest, of pushing against the establishment, of looking at the current system and ways of doing things and trying to package that in a rock musical. It's a huge change from Rodgers and Hammerstein. The Sound of Music is 1959, and then we have Cabaret in 1966. And Hair comes out as a concept album before it's even a show, just like the Hamilton mixtape, concept album. The tunes become popular, they're on the radio, everybody hears them, then eventually it gets the funding to become a stage production. But it's a reaction, and it's in the language of the young people of the day.
And it's revolutionary both in terms of the history that's being told of the American Revolution and then the revolutionizing of American musical theater right now at a time when everything is very turbulent, as you mentioned. Well, I'm going to go out on the Sound of Hamilton, but before I do that, let me thank my three guests for elucidating Hamilton, Sarah Marty, Joshua Calhoun, and Alexander Shashko. You've really helped me see and hear more things in the show. We're going to put some information about Sarah Marty's class coming up, about different websites that are of interest on our University of the Air website. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Ladies and gentlemen, you could have been anywhere in the world tonight, but you're here with us in New York City. Are you ready for a cabinet meeting, huh? The issue on the table, Secretary Hamilton's plan to assume state debt and establish a national bank. Secretary Jefferson, you have the floor, sir.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We fought for these ideals, we shouldn't settle for less. These are wise words, enterprising men quote them. Don't act surprised, you guys, cause I wrote them. Ow, but Hamilton forgets. His plan would have the government assume state debts. Now place your bets as to who that benefits. The very seat of government where Hamilton sits.
Not true.
Ooh, if the shoe fits, wear it. If New York's in debt, why should Virginia bear it? Our debts are paid, I'm afraid. Don't tax the South, cause we got it made in the shade. In Virginia, we plant seeds in the ground. We create, you just wanna move our money around. This financial plan is an outrageous demand, and it's too many damn pages for any man to understand. Stand with me in the land of the free. Pray to God we never see Hamilton's candidacy. Look, when Britain taxed our tea, we got frisky. Imagine what gon' happen when you try to tax our whiskey.
Thank you, Secretary Jefferson. Secretary Hamilton, your response.
Thomas, that was a real nice declaration. Welcome to the present, we're running a real nation. Would you like to join us? Or stay mellow doing whatever the hell it is you do in Monticello? If we assume the debts the union gets, a new line of credit, a financial diuretic, how do you not get it? If we're aggressive and competitive, the union gets a boost. You'd rather give it a sedative? A civics lesson from a slave, or hey neighbor, your debts are paid because you don't pay for labor. We plant seeds in the South, we create education.
keep ranting. We know who's really doing the planting. And another thing, Mr. Age of Enlightenment, don't lecture me about the war. You didn't fight in it. You think I'm frightened of you, man? We almost died.